Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Dinky Dawson and Tony Raine. Tony is definitely getting it together, and we wish him all the well. He's not with us today, but Sean McNally is in his place to take care of the interview it's more than a conversation, it's more than an interview. It's a conversation with Warren Scott, part two. And Warren, welcome to Two Pints in a Corner. And Sean, welcome to Two Pints in a Corner. Say good morning.
Thank you, Dinky.
Oh,
hello, gentlemen.
You're welcome. and it's good. Warren, we talked, after you left last week, we talked about one thing that really is in your heart, is why you tried to do it and what you did and tried to get you two to come to play the channel. Do you want to tell that story first, or have you got another story that you want to tell first?
Well, I want to bring up that one time at one point, it was 1983 or 84, I believe, not quite certain on the date. I had conversations with Paul McGinnis, who then was managing U2.
Yeah.
And I remember I'd have to get to the club early. I'll get to my office early. Because of the Dublin time was different than obviously the time in Boston.
Right. Yep.
So I had conversations with him, and going on the premise of using the gross potential to get X, we were speaking about possibly putting U2 in the channel for a whole month.
Wow.
A month worth of dates.
Wow.
And I can remember the gross potential was little bit more than $500,000. And I was talking to him, and he liked the idea, and we spoke pretty much for about 2 weeks. And unfortunately, he didn't end up doing it, but the conversations were very positive.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
you mentioned this after the call last week, when I was like totally, my interest completely peaked, because like, U2 is like one of my all-time favorite bands. When I heard that, I missed the story. My first thought was you were trying to set some time for them to come in and basically rehearse for a tour or something, but I didn't realize it was for actually have them perform.
It was actually for performances.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he liked the idea, and we talked about it day after day, and the reason he turned it down was financially he could make more money by playing different venues, and he didn't think that being in one venue at the time was the greatest idea.
What year was that? And that was what, mid-80s? It was from mid-80s, right?
Yeah, mid-80s, and the band was blowing up at the time.
Right. Because I think they played the Centrum 84, I think it was, maybe? 84. So yeah, you were probably talking like 82, 83, because I think they played the Orpheum.
Yeah.
Paradise was before that. So wow.
The Paradise was first, because that's what Carter got together with.
Yeah.
Them.
I thought I was going to get that show at one point. How good the conversations were going.
That's wonderful.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Incredible.
But you ended up with Bagatelle instead at one point, right?
What's that?
You ended up with Bagatelle at one point from McGinnis.
Bagatelle, you booked those guys, right, Warren?
Do you remember Bagatelle that came from Ireland?
Bagatelle from Ireland, I think you booked them at the channel.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that.
Oh, that was then.
That might have been a rental, actually.
I think you're right. I think it was a rental from the gentleman that owned these venues all over the place in Massachusetts. He had an underground thing going off with all the Irish bands and stuff coming through, and they did play there. I think it was a night they oversold the Guinness and had to go get more Guinness out of the.
I remember that story.
but it was.
We were talking in our last episode, and how you really had to be creative. We were talking about the whole playing the role of the underdog, pretty much, because that's the way it really was. And even to this day, like I said last time, Don Law still controls the majority of the acts that come through the Boston area, Northeast.
He's the promoter on record for the Northeast. Whenever bands come into town and they're supporting a record,
It's true.
The
yeah.
play with Don Lawrence, the Tea Party concerts and so forth, is the proper play at right. that now anyway.
Right, yeah. right. Well, they have so many venues they control, so that's really the key difference.
They're doing what you did with Spinal Tap. They're using different towns and stuff to get all these bands that come through from different parts of the world. And they may have a venue for 900 now. They've got one for 3,200. Is that what
their club venues are the Paradise and the House of Blues.
No,
they also have a music hall.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and all the new rooms.
Pavilion, and you know they got several other venues, big rooms in town. MGM.
Yeah, that's a big one.
They can really control an act from a 200 seat room to 5,000, and even now, obviously beyond that, you go to play the Gillette Stadium or Fenway Park.
Yeah,
they do those shows as well. So it's really soup to nuts. Yeah. You get a band on up. You want to obviously keep them in your corral, so to speak. But just like you did, the channel, we want to try and bring in bands, get them established in our room.
Yeah.
And hopefully they'll show some kind of, respect and come back next time.
Exactly.
Some kind of loyalty.
Exactly.
Play your room the next. Even if they're a bigger band, maybe they'll come back and do a couple nights or an off night, like an underplay, so to speak, one time here and there.
Exactly. Exactly. So on a different level, just my question before Sean gets into all his stuff here. Last week we interviewed and had a great time with Robert Harris Hall, and his first thing was before we even started was, I got to ask a question. Why didn't we play the channel more? Who booked us and why didn't they play? So I started saying, well, I can only see three or four shows here, and my shows didn't coincide with his. And then all of a sudden he says, oh, wow, we did play with Face to Face. We did play with this, and I'm looking through this, and he had David, the drummer, Stefan Halliday there, get on with him, and it was great. And and if it hadn't been for the channel, he wouldn't be where he is now. He says
they had high praise for the club, Warren, Robert Ellis Oral. So they played there. His band played there a few times in the early days, and he was on the bigger and better things than in Nashville and whatnot. He's back in the area, but he was just kind of reminiscing and they were talking about how they're like, why don't we play the channel more often? I just assumed they were on the road because he was such a prevalent songwriter and traveling and whatnot. But they made many mention of the fact that the channel was really the place, and it really gave them where they really got their chops down and really were so super appreciative of it. And they just kind of warned themselves, why don't we play them more often? I said, I don't know, maybe we'll ask when he comes the next time.
Robert,
there were bands that came in. A good example would be. Huey Lewis and the News. Huey Lewis and the News was booked into the club, and his album Sports had just come out. And it was $5,000, which was an okay paycheck. But by the time the channel played, it stayed with Huey Lewis and the News. He had three or four songs in Billboard's top 100, if not top 10.
Oh yeah, that's
so.
Yeah.
That's right. We were going to lose the act to a bigger venue until the fact that I told him that we can work the money out in a better situation for him. So it went from $5,000 to I think we paid him $10,000 at that time.
Was it just one show? Or they did more than one show.
Just one show.
Yeah, they blew up big time that year. They did the Power of Love single was gigantic.
And I couldn't have done that unless I had that gross potential.
Yeah, that's so exactly.
Gross potential to our advantage and kept the act.
Exactly.
Right, absolutely. So tell me, I remember a couple other occasions too. Maybe you can give us a couple where you really made a big hit or a big score, so to speak. You brought an act in at a really fair price or offer, and by the time they got to the date, not just like you would do a state, the band either had blown up or became, on MTV or something. So I remember a couple of shows myself where I can think of top of my head, like Tesla, Bullet Boys, or bands you paid. They were like kind of getting themselves out there in the world, so to speak, and they're just coming on MTV and get their record out there. But we had them at the channel pretty early on. They just banged the place out, and they stayed with us for a while, I think.
Yeah.
Red Hot Chili Peppers. I'll always remember them guys.
Yeah, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They played.
No, sure.
Five pairs of tube socks and five underwear. That was it. That's all I want. You gave me that
I
right.
I was there for the surface, sort of like that.
Oh, you were there pretty much at the end of the run, the channel, Warren. So when the channel did end up closing at the very end, what did you stayed in the business, so to speak. So give us a little bit of a background on like what you've been doing ever since mid '80s or early '90s till present day.
Well, when the channel closed, unfortunately, 1994, I believe.
Yeah, two.
It was before that, but it was early '90s for sure. This is really early '90s.
That the last show was in '92, and then it became a different venue after that.
Mm-hmm.
But the last show was right at the end of it. Well, not at the end, it was at the beginning of '92. And I'll get you the last one for you. I'll look for it.
I believe B.B. King was one of the last shows.
You might be right. I'm trying to get my memory. I remember going there on New Year's Eve for the cramps, and the doors were locked out front. Like either the tax had been paid or something happened. The club was shut down, and I completely forget if that was...
Yeah, that was the last show there.
The last show was January 31st, 1992. The Neighborhoods, 24th.
That's the last.
Outlaws and Tory Caldwell. Fahrenheit before that. Greg Hall the second before that. Physical Graffiti on the 10th.
You see when B.B. King played?
B.B. King's way before that. I will tell you when.
Was it?
Oh yeah. Well, B.B. King
wasn't the channel that B.B. played a bigger venue at that point. Because you were still doing shows, Warren. Like you said before, if an actor was pretty much bigger than the channel would hold, you just showed behind
to another venue,
behind the castle. Tell us about some of those other shows you did. I'm sorry, the Wang Center, I think, as well, or the Boston Opera House.
Yeah, we booked the Opera House for a couple of years. The Black Hearts played there. The Replacements played. Robert Palmer, Miles Davis played.
B.B. King, going back to, was November 27th, 1991, with Smoking Joe Bassiano, the guy who was really popular.
Bonamasso?
Yes, it.
Bonamasso.
Bonamasso, yeah. That was...
So that ended like early 90s in Warren. So just bring us back to, at that point, the channel closed, which obviously is very disappointing for a lot of us. So what did you do after that point to stay, either stay in the business, or how did you kind of evolve after that?
Well, I had an agency. I had an agency in at the Fort Point Channel that I represented. The sax player for Bruce Springsteen's band, Red Bank Rockers.
Clarence Clemons.
Clarence Clemons.
Red
Bank
Rockers.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, sure.
That was
sure.
One of our acts on our Jonathan Richman, the Modern Lovers.
Oh yeah.
Amongst some other acts, and we would tour them around the country. Junior Walker and the All Stars.
Yeah,
we toured them around the country. That agency was Bruce Solar, Michael Flanagan, and myself.
Oh, that's
right. Okay, sure.
That's cool.
So I have been in the business since the channel, prior to the channel, during the channel years, and after. I had my agency, which was called Pyramid Artists, and then from Pyramid Artists, I started Boston Event Works. And that's what I've done recently.
Ah, okay.
Tell us about what Boston Event Works does. It's not just a booking agency. It's kind of like an umbrella of different things you guys cover, right?
Right. Boston Event Works entailed Boston Event Works colleges, special events for corporations, as well as BE weddings.
Ah, okay.
We supplied wedding entertainment for weddings all over New England.
So the talent for the wedding, you're saying?
Right.
Excellent. Now, you also were managing bands for a while there. Were they mostly Boston bands, or were you just doing the booking for some of the other bands you mentioned earlier, like Clemons and
whatnot,
Junior Walker?
Yes, so I managed a local attraction called Pieces back then, which is a hard rock metal band.
I remember them, Pieces.
Since then, I had a little run with Sweet, who was multi-platinum band.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's fun.
You get us to current day now. You've been doing different stuff besides music. What else you been doing these days? Also, I'm like, oh, I can't think of a name that kills me. It's like, oh, here it is, but it comes back in my mind. But no, the idea is try and just reminisce as much as we can about the channel, what it meant, even to the point, Warren, now we've talked with a lot of artists who played the room, and how supportive the Boston music scene was in the 80s. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, how the relationships we had to have with the radio stations, with Strawberries, with the the Phoenix. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure. The radio stations were a key component of having a successful show. We did shows with WBCN, where they'd come in, put their logo on them in the newspaper and so forth, and they would promote the shows, give them X amount of tickets, giveaways and so forth.
Yep.
Yeah, and the lunchtime shows and stuff, the promotions.
Yep, the Phoenix newspaper at the time was a key, strong newspaper to have help promote a show. We would spend X amount of dollars, and they would match it. You know, to help promote a show.
And then, that was like the Bible back. I remember being in college. Like, the Phoenix was like the gold mine. When I came out on Thursdays, I would circle all the shows next 2 weeks coming up, make sure I had it on my calendar. But that was definitely a big part of it. And BCN, you mentioned, we had a lot of lunchtime shows with those guys. Just a special. Was the Turkey Drop Gun there too? Was that something that happened with the channel? Were we involved in that one?
Yeah.
They did the WKRP thing?
Yeah, we had a. I think I remember meeting with Fred Lewis regarding he was managing the Cars, and he also managed for a little while Steve Cataldo's band, the Nervous Eaters.
Oh yeah.
And we're going to do a show with the Nervous Eaters for at that time they were just signed to a major label.
Okay,
we're going to do a Thanksgiving type of show.
Nice.
I get you.
So you guys are doing all the heavy lifting. I'll answer the questions.
it's just kind of a trip down memory lane. I mean, give us some of the best, like Dickie mentioned last time, you were obviously in the room all day doing the booking job, which is, 9 to 5 and way beyond that, as we both know. The clock never stops, the phone never stops ringing, right? So then you also would come in quite a few times at night for the show. And like you said, to mix and mingle, meet the agents, meet the bands, meet the label people. Maybe just kind of describe how that whole process worked as far as how
how I got in that.
I guess how you work with the different people in the picture, like the radio stations, the labels, the band management companies, the booking agencies. Maybe just kind of go, like a walk through how that all worked with you and how you were involved in pretty much from A to B, A to Z, I should say.
Yeah. When a band releases a new song, they're most likely going to tour to support that song, to support the album in which the song's on, obviously. I'd hear the song on the radio, or I'd see it in print in Polestar or Billboard magazine, and I'd see that it's charting. What would pique my interest is where it entered into the charts. If it entered into the charts in the top 10, I'd have to think that unless it was an independent label, that it's going to be in a bigger room than the channel. Anything from the Orpheum to Boston Gardens. If it entered into the hundreds, the low 100s, it would be something that would pique my interest. And I'd want to see it into the club. So I'd get a hold of the agent. If I didn't know the agent at the time, I'd just call the record label, and the record label would give me the responsible agent for the act. And I'd call the agent, and I'd vie for the act. Sometimes there was another promoter already in there talking about a play date in Boston. Sometimes not. When The Clash played Boston, I know when The Clash played in New York City, I actually went to Bonds International in New York to speak to the band directly. Unfortunately, I didn't get that date either. It played either Metro or Boston, one of the figurations of the Lansdowne Street House of Blues, what it is now.
Yeah, right. But
I would go to the different live dates and I'd hit the soundboard first. And if I went to the sound man and asked him, you know, who's here that represents the band I can talk to about a play date for the band.
Yep.
And he'd usually direct me to where the manager is or where the agent is. If the agent wasn't there, I'd know who it was. I'd call him the next day. You know, a gig happened in that manner, or it happened like the B-52s. B-52s were in town one year, and they were playing a different venue, not ours, but somewhere yep. else in Boston. But they came to the channel to hang out after. So we let them in, and we, you know, afforded them a cab and what have you. So I would get to with the band, and I talked to them. One situation was with the B-52s. Fred Snyder was there. I was speaking to him, and I asked him. I said, Fred, how'd you like to play this club? Oh no, we can't do that. We're too big. I said, well. Maybe I can work out some kind of situation that might appease you.
Right.
And he'd tell me to speak to the agent. So the next day, I actually gave Fred a money figure that he reported to, who was it? I think it was Premier also, Premier
yep.
Talent Agency, Barbara Skydell at the time. And the next day, I remember I was shopping down at Jordan Marsh. I was buying some swimsuits to go to Jamaica with. and I called
Good
in
memory.
To I called him to Harry at the time, just to tell him I'm going to be on my way back. And he told me the B-52s just accepted an offer.
No.
Yeah. And
like
he actually wasn't too pleased because I put the offer in, but I didn't think nothing of it because I didn't think they'd take it.
Right.
Yeah,
wow.
And they actually took the offer and they confirmed it. And it was right before Christmas. And they played that year. And then they played 4 years following. Every year they returned and played
Amazing.
Right before Christmas. So I used a lot of face-to-face conversations with
sure.
bands and band managers and agents to
sure.
fill the calendar out.
No, good for you, man. You have to,
I love
do those
it.
Different things, like we said earlier. We kind of think differently than the other agencies because, you know, getting a face-to-face with somebody was a way, way better chance they might get back. But even
yeah.
yourself there, you were surprised they got back to you. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's real fantastic.
I think I was drunk at the time when I broke my But
Harry's money, it's okay. You made it back, for sure.
Right. But funny enough, they took the date, and it became a return date for 4 or 5 years following.
I think it's great. I love that story, Warren. That's a good one.
Yeah.
But did you ever come in at all, Warren, on shows because you were actually a fan of the talent you booked?
Come again, Sean, please.
You obviously booked all the shows there, but did you ever come in as like a fan when any bands you booked or performers you booked you were like really stoked to see because you were an actual fan of them yourself?
Yes. Oh, yeah. A ton of attractions. I mean, I have to admit, one of the reasons why I loved that job is because I booked bands I liked.
Love it.
Yeah, but also, if I wasn't familiar with the band, I mean, something like a Philip Glass, I would also bring them in if they were charting and they were showing promise that they can do 1,500 people in the room.
Right.
Whether I liked them or not.
Sure. Right.
But mostly bands I liked. Roy Orbison is an example of that.
That was great.
Roy Orbison hadn't played any club dates, but I brought the idea to CAA, Creative Artists.
Yep.
They took the offer to Roy's camp, and they confirmed. And that was two sold-out shows.
Yeah, that was a huge get. Those shows are incredible.
His last appearance.
Right.
I think he did appearance at the Front Row Theater the day after our last performance. So we had him on a Friday and Saturday, I believe, and then they played somewhere else, and then Roy passed right after that.
It was so surreal. I remember at the show, just like, you could hear a pin drop. He's singing, crying. I mean, just... His voice was still unbelievable.
This is
89, I think it was. It was, you know, he was in the business for a while at that point, but his voice is incredible. And I remember waking up early on, I think it was on Monday morning, and I had the radio on in the background, you know, WBZ's playing, and it's like, they say Ray Orbison died, and I thought I was just dreaming. Like, there's no way. I just saw him. And then, of course, it's true, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. He was so good.
He wasn't playing nightclubs at that time. He was just doing, he was doing mostly theater in the round.
Sure. Sure.
But, the, you know, CA liked the offer, and I pitched it correctly, and we got it. And that was a coup.
That was definitely a cooler because he was making an album in England with Traveling Wilburys. And he came to play a few dates in America just to make the contracts work, you know, legal for the legals. And
I actually asked him, I actually asked him in his tour bus. I said, Roy, can you play a tune off of Traveling Wilburys?
Yeah.
And He said, unfortunately, I can't. These guys, my musicians here weren't the same musicians that, you know.
Yeah, played on that.
That played on Traveling Wilburys.
George Harrison said that and Tom Petty the same. He said, once Roy started singing, we all shut up. It was just unbelievable when we all were tearing and doing the whole thing. As soon as he started singing,
he had quite a voice.
Oh, but such wonderful!
Something very, very—that's for sure. Very, very true.
On a totally different level. Just a quick question.
I'm sorry, Dan.
No, go on.
One more thing about Roy. He actually did those dates. He was a very giving man.
Yeah.
He actually did those dates, so his band musicians that do all the theater in the rounds could have some money that go out and buy their family Christmas presents.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Nice.
That's real nice.
That doesn't surprise me.
On a different level, on a totally different level, what's the Chuck Negron story since he's passed away just lately?
Who's that now?
Chuck Negron.
Chuck Negron, Three Dog Night?
Oh, I just did an event with Chuck Negron prior. It was somewhere around that time period, back in the Channel days. But he was just a wild guy to work with. I don't have a story about him, but just you knew Chuck, Dinky, correct?
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. I'm with the birds at the whiskey. Chuck would be coming in late night with a bunch of the guys, you know, the Freaky Dog Night stuff. He'd always get into some trouble down there because it's such a wild son of a gun he was at that time. I mean, not all the time, but at that time.
Yeah.
And roadie worked with me is Carlos Burnell. Carlos Burnell punched him out right in the middle of the whiskey floor and absolutely nailed him and said, we don't want these kind of characters in this place. And it's a bird's night, you know.
Yeah,
and I says, well, that must have been a bad one because he punched Chuck out. He's a damn good voice, you know. What's going on here? He's wicked. He's wicked, and what he did to people in some ways is terrible. To these girls that he was doing, it was terrible. So Carlos took it on him to say, get out of here, but he didn't want to go, so he just nailed him. And that was my Chuck story, but the other Chuck Berry story I'm hearing from you, you work with Chuck too.
I work with Chuck many times. Matter of fact, his agent, what's his name? I don't recollect his name. Chuck Berry's agent said to me that he'd only like to work with me in the New England area.
Dick Allen, I think it was, right?
It wasn't Dick Allen. It was... I don't recollect.
He had Chuck Berry and Little Richard for a while.
The reason I mention it is because Chuck was an interesting character to work with. I did the first Birds show that I ever did for the Birds was in Germany at a festival called Total Action Now. And it was 30 or 40,000 people out there. And Chuck was down there, and we were on there with a bunch of English groups and stuff. Now, we being the Birds, and I'd never hit a note with the Birds. I'd just met them and going the whole band, starting this little tour I was doing, just a friendly thing, you know. Anyway, Chuck didn't want to go on because he wanted to get more money for a start because he saw all these people.
Oh, yeah. So he was good like that.
So what happened is that he got his guitar and he started doing the duck walk around the perimeter of the thing, and all the audience was, yeah, chuck, 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 chuck. And he wouldn't go on the stage, but he was doing the duck walk. And then the guy who was promoting came back with a lot of money, cash, in his hand, and just went straight on stage and played an incredible set. We had the fun set, as I call it. And then the second time was he opened for The Who in the wrong place called Albert Hall. And when he opened for The Who, when The Who came on, they started, we want Chuck, all these rockers down there and what have you. It's a rock and modest thing, you know. And they started throwing things and a big fight happened. I jumped on stage because I was come to see Bobby Pridden from The Who and give him a hand. And we were all trying to keep The Who. So The Who could do the first song and quiet everybody down that was out the front, which was all the rockers. The carpets couldn't handle them. It was a different world, you know, and what have you. But he caused a riot there, and as much as Chucky, I mean, his songs are unbelievable, and how he performed them was really, really, really good. You know, I mean, let it down. And it's just, he didn't want to, if there was lots and lots of money he could see, he wanted money before he even started thinking about playing.
Oh, yeah, his satchel, $10,000.
Yeah.
He'd actually take that satchel and put it by the side of the stage and look at it the whole time.
Exactly.
When I worked with Chuck Berry, I've worked with him numerous times. You'd see Chuck in, like, the Opera House. I mean, the Opera House. Chuck, how was your flight? Up and down. Where's the stage? that was his thing.
That's a good one. Up and down. I want to see the stage. That's Chuck in a nutshell.
When Chuck played a date in Boston, his thing was he'd fly as far as Logan Airport, and then he'd want to get picked up by a car or by a service. This one time, I picked him up myself in my Jeep. And I'm driving through the tunnel in Boston, and the girl who takes the toll said to me, is that Chuck Berry sitting next to you? So I said, yep, that's Chuck Berry. We're driving down Starro Drive, and he said to me, I went to a lecture over there, and it was MIT. I asked him, who'd you see? Who was lecturing? Who was talking, Chuck? And he says, Albert Einstein. which I thought was interesting.
Wow. Chuck is hilarious. That's hilarious. All this audience is not going to believe all this stuff, but that's it's all true. Everything that we talk about, ladies and gentlemen, happened to ourselves and our lives. Go on, Sean. You've got some good ones to ask Warren again about certain shows that you want to talk about.
Yeah, well, I was really curious about the ones who were actually, he was a fan of, like the different acts. I mean, when you're the booking agent for a club with the channel,
that's true.
You have a lot of power as far as, you know, you don't have, if there's a band that, you know, obviously comes down to doing the business side of it, right, versus the personal preference on the business side, they got to be able to sell tickets, number one, to make it worthwhile. But also the ability or the joy to bring in some of your, you know, your favorite performers.
Exactly.
To see them in a place. Show that you booked, it must be an incredible feeling. I mean, I know it, and I was doing much smaller shows than you were. So you mentioned a couple of the guys you had seen over the years, Warren, you were really excited to see in person. And maybe part two of that is, were any of them, you know, personality-wise, to be you wish you hadn't met?
Question mark and the Mysterians.
Okay.
We booked Question and the Mysterians on 96 Tears was charting. Not his version. It was somebody else's version. So I booked them to get the excitement of the fast charting song.
Yeah.
And question mark stood in his U-Haul truck and his gear in it. All I can see was his feet. And this is how I communicated with the guy, talking to him with the. He couldn't be seen by anybody until he hit the stage. which is very strange.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. You did
What other performers, though, were you happy to see that you went there to see as a fan for the most part? I mean, you come to the show, but you're also a fan.
You know, Sean, there's too many to mention anything in particular. I mean, again, B-52s was a one. The early days with the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
That was a fan of the Go-Go's, and when we scored them the few times that we did, that was very special for me. Big Audio Dynamite was another one.
Oh, that was excellent. Excellent, Warren. Yeah. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
They did three nights one time. That was huge when they came through.
It was wonderful. It was really done well and promoted well. It's just like you had a Russian act. You had a Russian act.
Is there a Ramon story you could share about the channel?
I have a Ramon story. It didn't happen at the channel, but it seems people like to hear about the story.
I'm sure audience like to hear it anyways.
It happened at the main act.
Okay, that's what it was. Yep.
We put acts into the main act that would be playing Boston the next day, and we literally didn't have to advertise the bands. We could just put them on the concert line, and that's the way we'd put in the offer. So the Ramones played the main act in Wynn at the time, and they did the sound check. The bands went to the main act. It was also a hotel. So we had hotel rooms for him. The lead singer, Joey Ramone, went back to his room, and I guess he was doing Quaaludes, so he passed out. The band's on stage as the show started to happen without Joey. So I noticed that. The rest of the band's there, and they're tuning up. They're making noise, but the crowd was at a fever pitch. They were waiting for the band and Gabba Gabba Hey, you know. They were cheering the band on, but the band couldn't start because they didn't have their lead singer. So I had to run to their hotel room to find out where he was. He was passed out on his bed. I remember there was a girl that was putting makeup on in the mirror, and I was talking to her. She was looking into the reflection of the mirror, looking at me, and I'm looking into the mirror, talking to her, saying, "We got to get Joe on stage. We got a show we got to do here. The fans are destroying the room. Let's get him up." So we finally got him up, and we get him to the stage, and I'm walking him through the crowd to the side of the room, and it's a sold-out show. And as he's walking by, all the fans see him, and they're trying to touch him, and Joey, this, and all that you would imagine. And I finally get into the stage, but I overran the stage a little bit. I missed the stairs of the stage.
Oh, no.
So he's at the side of the stage, and he was kind of out of it. So he tries to get on the stage from mid-stage where the stairs were not at.
Oh, no.
And he's crawling on the stage, and I've got my hands on his back, and I'm pulling on his belt of his pants. And what happens all of a sudden? He's got his ass in my face at this point. What happens? He turns around, and he says, "Warren, I just shit myself." And I said, "I know, Joey. I'm well aware."
I
had to pull him down from the stage and bring him back to his dressing room. Now, at this point, the crowd was going fucking nuts.
Yeah, I believe
it. There was a wrought iron gate in front of that stage that the fans actually ripped up out of the ground. They took the bolts right out of the ground, and they surfed it over their heads to the back of the room. This is the gate that prevented people from rushing the stage.
Yeah, I get it.
So I get him back to his hotel room, and the girl's still at the mirror there, and she's not. And then we got to shower him, we got to wash him, and I got to get him on stage. So she's finally relented and turned around and started to help me, got him showered, got him dressed, put him back on the stage, and the show went off remarkably.
Unbelievable.
That's
the story behind the story, as you say.
Exactly. That's the best one I've heard for years. I love that one.
It was trying at the moment.
Yeah, very much so. God.
So do you remember off the top of your head, like the biggest, some of the biggest shows you did end up doing there with the gross over the years?
Yeah, we could have some big grosses as far as depending on what the ticket price was.
Yeah.
Right.
As we know, the channel capacity, legal capacity was 1,500, but some acts that they would do the business would do well over 1,500.
Yeah.
I think that room could handle more like 2,500 people at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I don't know if I told you, and this is your interview, but I'll just mention really quickly. I had when I was booking some of the hardcore shows there, the biggest show I ever did was Fugazi on St. Patrick's Day, 1990, I think, or 89, yep. or 90, 91. Yep. Anyway, what happened was, back then we sold tickets at Strawberries, as you remember, of course.
Morris.
So we had sold, I think we sold like 900 or something, like advanced tickets to Strawberries in the box office. We had about, I think, almost a total of 1,400 people or so.
Yeah.
So it comes Sunday morning, they had a show. The parking lot is just absolutely jammed. I mean, you couldn't see. There were so many people out there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, where do these people keep coming from? And what happened was, at the end of the day, we did, I counted all the tickets out and all that. What I realized was we sold 2,400 tickets. And the reason I found out is because I didn't even think to tell Strawberries to stop selling tickets.
Oh.
We sold tickets Saturday. Sunday morning, people came to the show, they wanted to buy their ticket, make sure they get in. They bought tickets on the way to the show.
Oh.
So it was literally like 20, and honestly, it was an honest mistake. I never even thought to tell Strawberries to stop selling tickets because I figured, I'm going to sell the place out. But yeah, 2,400.
Right.
Yeah, I remember, and they only charged $5 a ticket. That was part of their deal back then. And
right.
I remember paying them, and it was the most money they'd ever been paid before. They were stunned. But that was just one memory of going whatever capacity, for sure. So,
The room handled that kind of capacity.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Even though the legal capacity was one number.
Well, especially for a hardcore show, people all jammed in close and tight to each other, right? They didn't really care.
When Clarence Clemens played, to this day, I heard that the walls were sweating.
Oh, yeah.
There were
so many
people in the room. The Plasmatics.
Oh, yeah, that was what I was going to bring up, the Plasmatics and Wendy O. What was that? Was a cool.
Wendy O. Williams.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then
Rod Swenson. Rod Swenson was the manager at the time.
And then,
very scary guy.
Oh, my.
Yeah,
And then the girls doing wrestling. You had wrestling going off on there, WWA, whatever it was, wrestling.
Right.
And then you had model nights, and then you had so many different kinds of things going on separate nights that, mm-hmm. It was good to have different things going on because your mind and your body and your demeanor was changed all the time. It was so interesting. And
well, you can have different acts in the room, totally different from what you had the day before. I mean, it would just clear the room out. Sometimes an all-age show would happen in the afternoon. We'd have a nighttime show. We'd bring in a cleaning crew. Clean the room up.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Costa and then his daughter, who's turned into an amazing lady herself, would be cleaning up, off the night and stuff and what have you. And then next morning.
Yeah, Maria Menounos. Right.
Maria, yeah. And then the next day, there'd be Al outside who would clean up all the bottles. Jack would give him pint of beer and stuff. So
Al the Bum, we called him.
But he was also a veteran and stuff.
Right.
He was pretty smart underneath that craziness. He did. He saved.
Yeah, so you
saved
James Costa. Brown played the room. That was one of your shows, I assume. Yes.
Yes. Yep. I booked James Brown.
Did he play there once or more than once?
I want to say I know James Brown played the main act.
He did play the channel.
I think it was one time.
Yeah,
that was the time when we booked the channel and
I should look through the thing.
Put him at the Double Suites Motel, not the suite that he expected. he called me. I remember I was in the shower and he called and he said, "Mr. Scott, this is Mr. Brown," and I said to him, "Andrew, cut the shit. Stop messing around."
Right.
I thought it was Andrew fooling around.
Yeah, he's good at that.
James Brown. called from his car, from his limo, in front of the double suites. And as you know, double suites is nothing more than a big room with two beds in it.
Right.
And his rider called for a suite, a legitimate suite. So I thought I could get away. So I had to get on the phone and find a suite for him in short time.
Very short time.
When I got to the room, he had curls in his hair. And he said, sorry about that earlier, Chuck.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
I think that's great.
Go ahead, Dickie.
No, it's, that's great. I'll let you have a couple more questions, then we have to close out another one. Warren, your stories of your and your life is unbelievable. You really have got that amazingness.
Yeah, got a few of them.
Yeah. Couple other things. One thing that, you know, we all know what a rider is, right? But maybe just give a quick little description for the listeners. What's a rider? And then also, tell me some of the craziest requests you saw on riders that you had to see them all approve them all.
Yeah. Oh, when you book an act, you have to go by a contract. The contract comes in. The contract says how much you're going to pay them, what the capacity is, what the ticket price is, and it can't be alleviated from that. If it's $10 a ticket, we got to stay at $10 a ticket. There was a time when promoters did the wrong way by upping the ticket price the day of the show, and the promoter would pocket the difference between a $10 ticket and a $15 ticket. So the contract's very different. Attached to the contract is a rider, and the rider says everything else you need to have for the artist: your sound system, your light system, on stage monitors, front of house monitors, where they're mixed, and so forth. Also, what their hospitality is going to be, what they want to eat. You know, they're all totally on the road, so they're at the promoter's whim to feed them.
Right.
So you have to go by the rider. I've seen all kinds of things on the rider. Anything from wiffle balls and wiffle ball bats to cocaine. Obviously, we never complied with that, being that it was an illegal substance. But there's been some. Van Halen with no brown M&Ms.
Yeah, you know why that's you know why that is.
Why is that?
The story is that if you have brown M&Ms still left in the bowl when they come there, they know that you've never read the rider.
Oh, that makes sense.
That's what it's all about. It's not about their little quirms or anything. I mean, it's like a different level. You get Joe Cocker, two cases of Dom Perignon used to be on his rider and stuff like that. But when it comes down to the
rider,
for Red Hot Chili Peppers, the same thing. You had, like I said before, five pairs of underwear and five pairs of socks.
Oh, yeah.
Tube socks and stuff like that. So, it's like Lemmy.
Condoms.
Lemmy wanted marital aids instead of food. I gave him marital aids. We sent the bouncer across to the combat zone.
Lemmy from Motorhead.
Yeah, Motorhead was amazing. I mean, talk about a talent and a half.
Yeah, that was a good show.
Lemmy.
That was a score too.
That exactly.
Maybe,
oh. So anyway, we should be looking at the end of this one, and maybe another day we'll do another one because you got so much good stuff, Warren. It's like us all. We're saturated with everything because it was day to day. I mean, and I'm pulling out certain things now. I'm finding out, stuff like I was telling you earlier about Robert Ellis Oral. He came special to see Dwight Yoakam and Robert Earl, and it changed his life.
Yep.
It changed his life.
Do you know how Robert Earl got one of the reasons he got his start in Boston?
No.
Actually, a mechanism that did get his start. When his album came out, Naked Girls, his agent, no, actually his manager, arranged to have two strippers from the Naked Eye take the album and drop it personally off at WBCN and WCOZ. Oh, wow.
I love it. Both stations.
WBCN was interviewing Jim Longborg at the time. The two girls came into the studio unannounced, holding the Naked Girls album, and dropped their mink coats that they were wearing, and they'd be completely naked, and hand the album over to the jock that was on air at the time.
That's awesome.
And that got him airplay at two stations at that moment.
Shocking.
At the time
it was back then, there's a whole different world. You could go into the actual radio station. We had radio stations with actual DJs and actual personalities.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Playing actual Perino. Local music, not just program crap, you know?
So, exactly.
Mark Perino was the jock then.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, oh, sure. He was a jock. When that happened?
Yeah, he was a jock on BCN when that happened. And Leslie Palmer was the jock over WCOZ.
Oh, my.
Oh, yes.
That's great stuff.
I'm not sure she was on the air at the moment, but she was with the crew.
Yeah, that's great.
Just one more quick question: were you ever? Because we had some live recordings from the channel. I know Iggy Pop did that. I know John Butcher did. There's a few acts that played there and did like a live, even like a King Biscuit Flower Hour kind of thing. Were you involved in that stuff at all?
Some of those were pre-planned prior. Artist knew that he was doing a recording session at the time.
Gotcha.
Tesla. Recorded an album there.
Yeah,
that's right.
We got thanked by him on their album.
That's right, like a 5-man acoustic jam or something like that. Remember that?
Yeah, they did a live album at the channel.
Yep. They played there quite a few times too. They were great.
Iggy Pop one was a good live album. He did a good job too. You know, that one did. That one was a monster in Germany and the live.
Iggy Pop played the channel 1 week. It was at the Vinyls.
Yeah.
A reggae act, which sold out. And then the big Iggy Pop at the end of that run.
Awesome.
We had three or four acts that sold out in 1 week.
Yeah. And I know it kept everybody busy. I mean, going back to one thing I forgot to say. Remember Al Outside? He actually saved Costa's life one day. He came in. Costa was having a fit with
a diabetic fit.
He saved. It was instrumental in saving Costa's life. I mean, Costa was one of the better of the crew that lived and worked there. You know, I mean, wonderful man, wonderful.
We love Costa.
Yeah, I just thought I have to bring that up, but Al wasn't as crazy as people thought he was. You know, he just that was how he wanted to live his life on the street, basically.
Right.
But real quick,
I'll just bring up. You mentioned that Iggy Pop week. I just put the calendar up real quick, Lauren. This is amazing too. Just to give people an idea of the kind of the kind of acts that came through here. This is in 1 week. So on the 13th. This is July 1988.
Right.
Third World was in. The next night, Flotsam and Jetsam, Fates Warning, and Wargasm. The next night, Crocus, Leslie West, and Mountain. The next night, Nina Hagen. The next night after that was the seller you were talking about, the reggae show. Marcia Griffiths, 10 Stitches, Red Dragon, Sanchez, Wayne Ranks. And then Iggy Pop the next day. The next day was Circle Jerks. The day after that was the Divinals.
Yeah.
Next day was John Mayall's Blue Breaker. I mean, it was incredible. Then Hurricane and King's S and Overkill. It was every day.
Right. Every day.
10 days in a row. Incredible.
Yeah, I can remember that week. Out of all the weeks I spent at the channel, I remember that week in particular.
It was incredible.
Very busy.
Very busy.
God, yeah.
You come from work straight into it. You couldn't get away from it. It was just so well.
We always talk about that. How one of the beautiful things about the channel was the diversity of the booking, right? Because we would have, like, we just show that they have a reggae show, a metal show, a punk show, a jazz show on occasion, reggae. Anything under the sun was open to the channel. The rap shows, we had a couple of those as well. So that was really a beautiful thing about the club that you were also responsible for.
Yeah, definitely.
As long as it put asses in the seats.
Well, we should Sean wants to be able to do another one of these, because we can keep thinking of it as you go along, and you just started some really killer stories there, you know, absolutely. that you know, it's your life.
Thank you for making the time. It's been a good memory stay to talk about again. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I really do.
I appreciate you guys.
Really do, and I really, really thank you. And thank you for being the Brooked agent of the channel that had some spirit in him and still does.
I hope people find it interesting.
Oh, I know. They sure will. They sure will. So here it is, part two of Warren Yaffe, Scott. I mean, boy, that was the original name, and you changed it to Scott. And I tell you this.
I never changed it. I use Warren Yaffe in my personal life, and my moniker in the business is Warren Scott.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. We always have, I'm a Dinky and not a Stuart.
So, what's your real name, Dinky?
I'm a Stuart.
Dinky. Oh, you're Stuart. That's right.
I'm a Stuart Dawson.
Stuart Dawson.
Yeah, and my mother was.
Dinky, you're the man. We should be interviewing you.
Well, a silent book club wants to do that next week from New York City. They're interviewing.
How are you feeling nowadays, Dinky? How's your health? How's your health? Oh, you good?
I'm doing my best. Nancy's looking after me every day. I'm 4 days a week on dialysis, but we're doing it at home. And
give Nancy my best, would you please?
I certainly will. She's giving her best. She's sat across from me. And
Oh, is she there?
Love and hugs, Warren.
Yeah, love and
hugs. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Warren.
Hi, Nancy. How are you, honey?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
He's good.
Thank you for all this, Nancy. It's very nice.
We love your stories.
We love your stories. We love what you've done all these time. And Sean is just absolutely wonderful with you because he respects what you've done on every level, even the crazy stuff. Yeah. But the crazy stuff turned out wonderful.
Sean's a music man.
And you are too. You've got all that spirit in you. And I'm glad that you booked all those that you really liked because that's one of the reasons I stayed there is because it was so different 7 nights a week.
Yeah, and it was a vibrant joint.
Exactly. All right, with that said, we're going to end Two Pints in a Corner with Warren Scott and Sean McNally and Dinky Dawson. Tony is recuperating, and we hope that he really gets it together by next month, but we don't know, but he's gone into
I send my best to Tony.
Yeah, we've been doing that every time we do that, and now he's fighting in a new way because he's in his own apartment. The assisted living, so that they look after him and stuff, and every day 24/7, and that's the where it's at when we get this age, unfortunately. And your body starts crapping out. Well, it's what it is. I mean, there's so many friends of having issues and this, that, and the other. But it's all the body. The mind's still there. Everybody wants to do what we were doing 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I love it, you know. And I appreciate you, Warren, remembering, because you are remembering a lot of stuff. And
I went over in the podcast, on your menu, you have club shows. So it's wonderful how you have every show and every attraction that played the channel. Right from the very beginning to the very end.
Well, that's
very sour.
That's you. That's what you did. That's what all the booking in there. And it's respect to every one of you, the people, the hostesses, waitresses, the people behind it, you know, the like Sean and security and stuff, but then Sean promoting in there and taking care of productions in there and whatever. It was a place to really energize ourselves and get our lives together, and we didn't have to travel. I mean, the nearest thing you do it right now is casinos. You go to a casino, you play there, you stay upstairs or wherever and hang out, and you do go back to work. And I did that in the 80s, early time before the channel with the mamas and papas, and loved every minute of it. And I said, if this is the new way to go, I'll let the audience come to me, and we don't have to travel. We can just have a great old time, you know. Play music.
It was a job.
All right.
It was a job, and it needed to get done.
Yes, definitely. With that in mind, this is Two Pints in a Corner, signing out.